The following interview is with Mrs. Mary Kurtz at her home outside of Hillsboro on August 30th, 1978. During the hour-long conversation, she recounts the stories that have been passed down through the succeeding generations of her family concerning the Indians living in Washington County. During her years as a school teacher at the Seth School in Patton Valley, her and her students conducted historical research on their own concerning these Native Indians.
Hi.
To begin with, this afternoon, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell me who you are and where you were born.
I was born Mary Edith Patton, and I was named for my great-grandmother, Mary Elizabeth Sherwood, having my mother's middle name of Edith. But I was the third generation of Mary E. Patton on the ranch, and I was born on the original Patton Ranch at the head of Patton Valley, which was close to Cherry Grove, but that was before Cherry Grove was started. And the Pattons had come across the plains in 1850. My grandfather walked across the plains at 9 years old and carried a Kentucky rifle. And so I was steeped in history of the pioneers and the early settlers, and grew up under that kind of influence. And that's why I'm interested. I married George Kurtz in 1934 after I'd been teaching 3 years, and we've lived on the ranch for many, many years, and then moved Hillsboro after we sold it.
Mm-hmm. Your grandfather settled out in the
yes,
what is now known as Patton Valley.
Great-grandfather settled there, and it was named for him and his brother. And then his son was Matthew Patton, my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was Pim Patton.
Was your great-grandfather and his brother then the original settlers?
Yes,
the first people in this valley?
Well, practically.
First
they got
white
it,
person, I
yes,
should say.
They got it from the, they got their land from the original owner of the donation land claims.
Mm-hmm.
The original donation land claim with the President Grant's signature is in our abstract. So we're right at the beginning. And there were very few settlers in the valley when they came.
What are the stories that have been passed down through the generations as far as the geography or the particular landscape around Patton Valley? Was it pretty much like it is today?
Very much. A lot of the land had to be cleared, and my folks were especially apt at getting that done. They were good in handling saws and axes, and all of them were carpenters. Great-grandfather was a blacksmith, and when anything needed fixing, he fixed it. The fields were cleared, and early crops were grain and things and hay. And then later they raised hops for many, many years in some of the big fields there. They've always logged off the old ranch. It was logged clear down till the time we left, and then was finally cleared off.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always been logging and lumbering and mills in the area, many of them on the old ranch.
Since the original white settlement, then it's been a traditional
farming and logging
community.
Mm-hmm. Farming and logging, yeah, that's right.
All right, you've given just a brief history of of your family,
mm-hmm.
But as you well know, the major interest today, I think, is the stories of the 12 Indians in the Patton Valley. And to open up the topic, why don't you just tell me why you have become interested in this and some of the events that led up to your knowledge of the 12 Indians, or what provoked your interest?
Stories from grandmother telling about her mother-in-law's experiences, and then my own experience in made it so that I started collecting all the stories I could possibly find about the Indians. Grandmother Patton told of her husband's mother telling her how when she had first moved in there as a young wife, the Indians kept coming by and begging her for food. Well, she'd hand out home-baked bread, and of course they liked that very much. But they didn't take it and go, they kept coming back. And she got tired of that. She was a very accommodating and friendly person, but she got tired of being imposed on. So she pulled a naughty trick on them. They dearly loved her dried apples, and they came by one fall. I think there were two of them, as I remember the story. And she gave them all the dried apples they would eat. And then she gave them some coffee. And of course they had a tummy ache. And she said at least those two Indians never came back. It didn't poison them and it didn't kill them, but it surely made them uncomfortable when those dried apples swelled up. That was her story. But they told, then my own father remembered seeing a few Indians coming down off the mountain through their barnyard in the 1870s, 1880s, along in there. But there weren't any number of them. He tells me that the original log cabin that great-grandfather and grandmother built on the place had portholes at the corners for them to put rifles out in case the Indians had an uprising. And the neighbors were all warned. There was a big bell back of the house to ring and to call them in case of an emergency, but none ever came. None of the Indians were ever anything but friendly.
You mentioned that the Indians came by your grandmother's place for food.
Yes.
Was this common among the other farmers in the area? Would they have visits?
I suppose it was, although my only knowledge is of our own family stories of it. Mm-hmm. But there were Indians there because that was in the 50s and 60s, and there were still Indians around.
Do you think this might have been because of a shortage of food on the Indians' part?
I think so. The white settlers had come in and scared the deer away and caught their fish in the river. My family all liked to go fishing as a family tradition. And I'm sure the Indians were hungry, and they loved the white men's food. Mm-hmm. They didn't have anything to compare to Grandma's bread.
Was there ever any mention of Indians craving other particular white men's food, such as ground flour or sugar?
I think the sugar, she talked about them liking the dried apples because they were sweet. And I'm sure her dried apples were sweet apples that we had a sweet apple tree in front of the house. And I'm certain that her apples were from that tree. They would have been, naturally. And that they were the sweetest apples anyone ever tasted. And if she had some of those dried, it's no wonder the Indians liked them so well.
When your great-grandfather first arrived, then, the Indians were, that was during the 1850s, we're saying.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Let's see, there must not have been too many Indians then anyway.
No, there weren't. No, there weren't. No. There never were a whole, you know, a whole group of them or a tribe of them that anyone ever mentioned it. All they ever mentioned was that a few Indians would come by. And my father said he remembered seeing one or two, and they weren't particularly afraid of them or concerned about them, but they did come down over the mountains. So.
Then the original settlers in the Patton Valley never did really see the Indians in their tribal or group.
No, not that
group,
I know.
Habitat. All right. You mentioned that some of your interest derives from the fact that you were a teacher. Maybe you could elaborate on this a little bit more of how you first began this interest within the school and some of the things that your students partook of.
We had a lot of the grandchildren of the early settlers there. And while my family were the Pattons in the upper part of the valley, Grandma Seth came to the valley there and had been there as a little girl, because her name had been Lee. And in 1864, she married James Seth, and I had some of the grandchildren of that family in my school. And they told me that Grandma Seth said when she was a tiny girl, she remembered seeing a few Indians, two or three Indians, up on this rock wall. And she claimed she saw them up there. And she didn't know whether they were looking at them or whether they were drawing them. She wasn't sure of the exact fact. But she did see them there. And another young man told us that his father had talked to what he called the last remaining old Indian. And he said that when the Indians got sick from this epidemic of smallpox or measles, whichever it was that swept through and killed so many of them off, and they buried them in graves, and the old Indian told this fellow's father, Mr. Smith, that they drew the pictures and that those indicated the story of the tribe. There were three men, apparently, and one woman, if we can guess what the figures meant. And then they moved out. No more hunt, no more fish. They left the valley. Well, that had actually happened, we knew. So whether this story is exactly true or not, we know that that's exactly what had happened, that they did get sick. Mm-hmm. And that it probably came from the epidemics of the 1830s. And when they died, they buried them there. We religiously scraped around in the ground, and we found evidences of campfires, and we were sure we located the spots when the children, the students and I were there.
You found evidences of campfires? Mm-hmm. I mean, rock pits?
The burned. We dig down, 6 or 8 inches, and find charcoal. And at the same time, we were picking up all kinds of scraping tools and cutting tools of the obsidian and heavy and hard stone that the Indians had used. We found very few arrowheads, but we found lots of utility. Mm-hmm. Tools, and we ended up getting quite a lot of things that we could put in a display and get to Pacific University when the school closed. My father and his sister told about when father was about 11 and his sister would have been 13, they were hauling wood to Forest Grove to sell, and dad and his sister would run down over the hill and play in the sweat house at the foot of the hill. Well, for years, I thought they meant that they'd found this edifice made of willow branches over a pile of rocks that is described in all the Indian storybooks for the sweat houses in eastern Oregon. Well, when I finally questioned my aunt, who was still alive at that time, she said, oh no, it wasn't that kind of a sweat house. It was one that was a cave dug into the bank. And she said it wasn't very deep, but it was cool down there. And there was a little pond out in front of it. And they said that the Indians, especially when they got this smallpox or measles and their fevers got high, they'd go in the sweat house and get real hot. They'd pour the water over the hot rocks that they'd rolled in. And then they'd run out and jump in this little lake out in front. And of course they got pneumonia and died immediately. And that's why they buried so many of them, had to bury so many of them up on the hill.
This sweat house then, is this up on the hill itself? I mean the actual cave, is it up?
I'm sure there'd be no reason why there wouldn't be indications.
Mm-hmm. However, it is on private property.
Yes, it is. And a person wouldn't go in without getting the permission of the local people. The lady whose home was built on what we call our Indian medicine man's teepee location She's found arrowheads in her garden when she hoes her garden. And she's all as interested as we are about the early stories.
You mentioned the medicine man teepee, or home. How did this story start, or who told you?
This just came down through the parents and grandparents of these students I had in school. And I kept asking around the community. We had lots of wonderful community meetings of the parents coming to school for programs and things. And we had a lot of good chance to visit with them. And I did that. And one of the men who was on our school board told of, I think it was about the middle 1920s, and his slip scraper that he was pulling with a team of horses cut into a bank and cut into one of the graves that was left there. And he said they thought it was an Indian woman's grave because it had long black hair. And the hair just disintegrated into dust the minute the air atmosphere struck it, because it was terribly old. And he said he didn't actually find any bones. There were a few beads and things of that sort, but nothing to indicate real remains because it was terribly old. But he said there was evidence of hair there.
You don't know then where the story of the home actually being there, the story itself originated then? From
no,
who, or
it
what
was,
source?
I think it was the story, I know it came from the family of Mrs. Seth, Grandma Seth, some of those people. Now I don't know whether it was her son or grandson that told me.
Then the sweat house wasn't in use by the Indians even during the first years of the 1850s then?
Well, no, not that we know of. Now you see, it was 1870-80 before my folks went down to play in it. Mm-hmm. So there's no way of knowing that I would know how long it had been since it had been used. Mm-hmm. But there was still definite evidence there.
We were talking of the rock carvings up on the hill in the valley. You mentioned that the story was told of this old Indian telling the story to your grandfather?
To the father of one of the men who grew up in my generation. Mm-hmm. And when he was very young, he talked to this.
When was this story then told, or when was the Indian telling the story?
Well, it had to be in somewhere between 1860 and 1870. Mm-hmm. And the Indian was very old, and the man who had repeated it was very, very young when he saw the Indian. And then he repeated it to the next generation.
This old Indian then assumes, we assume, was there at the time when the rock carvings were being made.
Yes, and he told, when questioned, he told about it and told them that. Mm-hmm. They drew the pictures and all got sick and died, and they, but the ones left drew the picture story of the tribe.
This was during the malaria epidemic during the 30s then.
That's what was indicated, and he could have been 70, 80 years old at the time he told the story. Mm-hmm. So he really could have lived in the time that the epidemic was there.
Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm questioning a little bit here is there was two epidemics conjectured. One during the 1780s, which was, some people, authorities say, was a smallpox epidemic. And then during the 30s, it is thought to be malaria rather than smallpox during that time. And I'm just wondering which epidemic the rock carvings must have been made. I would assume it was the 30s, being that.
That's what Dr. Haynes from Monmouth told us. He thought the history base that he knew of the history of the Indians in Oregon. He said he was pretty sure it was between 1830 and 1835, along in there, that there was the epidemic. And he said our Indians traveled back and forth and visited with the Columbia River Indians, and the chances are that they brought the disease home with them. It swept through the tribe. The tribes weren't too healthy anyway because they had were small.
The original white contact, such as your great-grandparents with the Indians, it's hard to draw generalizations from it because they were just meeting with the stragglers or the remnants.
That's all.
But did they ever, were any stories passed down as far as their physical appearance or such as their height, weight, color of skin, length of hair or dress, anything like that
I
at
don't
all?
Remember anything that of that. Kind. Had I been as smart as I am now, I would have asked questions, but I don't remember any of that. They were all pleasant. Their characteristics that way, they were pleasant. They were demanding of food, but they were pleasant. There were no hostilities ever mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I can contribute from that side of it.
Mm-hmm. Then were there, I guess we covered quite a few of the stories of the white contact with the Indians. Were there
mm-hmm.
any others that you recall, other original families that might have passed down stories through their
ancestors? No, I think that's about all. All of these parents of the children that I had there had spent their spare time digging into the graves, and the people before them had, of course, so that by the time we got around, all the graves had been totally obliterated. They're just, we couldn't even find the depressions that the parents told about having seen when they were kids. And I don't know what we would have done if we ever found a grave. We would have been scared to death of it, but and knowing that you're not supposed to do things like that, it didn't bother me a bit. We never found the graves. It didn't bother us at all to go out in the field and find some of the relics. That was lots of fun. And we spent a lot of time classifying them. We got N.G. Seaman to come out, who wrote Indian Relics of the Pacific Northwest. He and his wife came out and visited in the school, and we just had a ball. We took them up to the writings on the cliffs, and they helped us identify things in our collection. And then Dr. Haynes and his wife and granddaughter came out, and we had them go through it with us. So we had two authorities. It wasn't just a pipe dream of ours. It really was, we had an authority to help us identify the things. So.
Well, before your school field trips, then there was amateur excavations
all over the hillside there.
Quite a few years before that,
yes,
by the original
had families. They'd been doing that for 75 years at least.
Mm-hmm.
And this, we started unearthing the writings on the cliff by pulling the moss gently off with our fingers. I wouldn't let them use any sticks or anything because we didn't want to wreck anything that we might be pushing on. And we did that in either 1942 or 43, and it was covered with about 2 inches of moss then. And one little girl finally, we heard they were there from the grandparents and the parents, and we didn't know where they were, so we went up there one afternoon and started looking, and one little girl finally found 2 holes in the rock and stuck her fingers in them. She said, "What are these?" Well, they turned out to be the eyes of one of the drawings. And then we unearthed the rest, and there were two sets of drawings. One, the large collection of 4 figures, and a lot of other things that we had no way of interpreting other than guessing what they represented, sun and the moon and the stars, or what they represented. But then there was a second, very indistinct group, but there still were some lines, not particular drawings that you could identify, but there had been things there.
Well,
so there was quite an extensive amount of drawings. They extended over quite a long
mm-hmm.
distance.
Did you ever see the to the east of the figures is more Indian drawings? Did you ever come
yes.
across those?
Yes,
too?
Yes, we looked at those, but it's hard to identify what they meant
mm-hmm.
with them. You can only guess.
When people such as Dr. Haynes and this other man that you mentioned, did they ever make any educated guesses as to what the figures meant themselves?
Not particularly. Dr. Haynes and Mr. Seaman both said that they were typical Indian drawings because to all appearances they had three legs. And we said, well, that's kind of, you know, that doesn't sound like Indians drawing, but they said that is typical. And by going through these books that show the Indian drawings, that is typical. It would be like a puppet on a stick is the way they look to a person looking at them. And why the men didn't know why they drew them that way, but they did. And they said probably someone trying to imitate this would never think to put the third leg on it. And it was just as long as the legs, but it looked like a three-legged person. But they said that was, and we talked about that especially, well, is that genuine? And they said, yes, it is. So.
What were these markings to the west of the figures then?
They were just lines in various connections drawn into the rocks, and we weren't sure that they were part of the thing, but because they were close and they were drawn into the sandstone, mm-hmm. we suspected it. And of course the grass had grown over them quite a bit too. So.
That's the kind of rock we're talking about then. It's mm-hmm. sandstone.
Sandstone, and of course that weathers away, and eventually it's all going to be gone. But
let's see here. Okay, we can continue with some of the things that were some of the sites up there. You mentioned to me yesterday you and your husband were talking of these dirt mounds.
That's right.
Could you describe these?
They were about 8, 10, possibly 12 feet across and about 2 feet high. And there was a whole series of them. And they were just a series of these mounds. And even after we moved on to the ranch, we helped level down four of them in the field that we were going to plant. And I was there when my dad leveled down the rest of them on the lower edge. And Dad always guessed that they were locations for the summer camps where they'd pitch their teepees. Oregon still gets kind of damp in the summertime even. And it was a nice way to be close to the fish and still have their teepees out of the moisture, and they'd be up so they wouldn't get wet that way. And also Father always theorized that Indians were very, very smart, and they knew that the river never, even in the spring freshets, never overflowed there, and it never did. There was never water. No matter how big a flood we had, it never came up where those mounds had been located. We searched a lot and never found any indication that they were burial grounds or anything of the sort. They were just evidently living quarters. And there was a whole series of them, so if that's what they were, and there was no reason to think they weren't, because they definitely had been built by somebody, and the white people hadn't done it. So the original ones, my father and his father and his father, all thought that they had been left by the Indians before they moved out. If that's true, then that was the place that they had their summer camps, because there were deer right across. Of course there wasn't any road, it was only a trail then, but there were deer just across the river, in fact both sides of the river, and there were lots of fish in the river at that time, so it had been an ideal place to, lots of berries, blackberries and all kinds of berries. Up and down the hills.
Was it just dirt, or were there rocks mixed in with these?
No, it was dirt. We didn't have to haul any rocks out. No, it was just dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Just dirt, sandy loam piled up in pine.
Was it packed rather?
Yes, it
rather
was.
Tightly
it,
then,
yes, it took a lot of scraping to get it down when we had to smooth it off. He had to use his disc and a drag and a lot of hard work to smooth them down. Knowing what we do now, we should have saved them. But
well, how wide were they then?
They were anywhere from 8, 10 feet, 12 feet wide. They were big. They weren't just little mounds, they were big mounds, and they stood up two and a half feet. So they were very evident. There was all these humps going down along the river.
Yeah, they must have been quite noticeable.
They were noticeable.
So it's definitely not a natural formation.
No, it wasn't something that had washed in there or had, you know, just happened. We were very interested in it. Of course, my dad was always interested in things like that, and he said that all the old settlers believed firmly that it was of Indian making.
Was this the only area that they were found?
Yes, that's the only place that we know of. Now, I never heard of any place else. I'm a little puzzled as to why we didn't find other things in there. Working tools and things, but I would guess that they'd been picked up by people there before we got there to pick things up. So there wasn't anything left for us except the mounds, and the mounds were there.
There were no artifacts at all found
there. Was nothing there that I know of found in there. My dad had found lots of arrowheads as a kid all around through there, but by the time I came along, there weren't any arrowheads left for me.
You were talking of some of the, you were saying there was a lot of deer and fish in the rivers and a lot of berries. There were native plants still growing in that area, such as?
Lots of wild blackberries along the river there, just lots of them.
Salal, we're talking about.
Yes, there's salal, and then I'm talking about the old wild blackberry, the one that has the vine. And they loved those. They liked all the berries. And there were several native trees that had berries on them that they'd use those. Of course, they'd use them with their fish and fix them for their winter, and they'd dry the deer and meat and make jerky out of it. We call it jerky. They didn't.
All right. We were also mentioning yesterday of the Mount Richmond Indian Trail. Or we mentioned it anyway. Where exactly was this trail?
Well, the only thing I can say is that my dad said they came down right down the middle of the mountain and came down through the barnyard. There is a stream that comes down through there, and they would have come fairly well along it. The only reason I can think that they might have come through there was that they were coming from some of the one tribes over on the Amhill River area or something like that. I can only guess at that because it's a kind of a high mountain there. But it's between the Amhill area and the Patton Valley area.
Mm-hmm.
And
was there any evidence of the trails in existence when you were a young girl?
No, because we had so much livestock that they had run over everything. And there was a common trail that came down the mountain, but there's no way of knowing whether it was the Indian trail or not.
It possibly could have been.
Oh, it could have been. There's no reason why it couldn't, because they were smart people. They'd take the best traveling. The folks had used, they'd done logging and things up there, so that a lot of it would have been covered up.
All right, we were talking, you were mentioning that your school children and the original families would dig up a lot of these artifacts when people would plow their fields. Could you describe some of these things that were found in quantity and
Well, probably we found rocks, the mortars. We never actually found any of the bowls. The mortar bowls were given to us by the people around there. Sometimes they'd break them with the plow, but sometimes they'd get a whole one. But we found some of the pestles, the stone grinder centerpieces, and we found lots of pieces of sharpened, obsidian. Of course, that had to have been traded and brought in from eastern Oregon. but real hard tools, some of them in the shape of a half moon that Dr. Haynes said was used to scrape arrow shafts smooth, and lots of pieces that were sharpened on one edge with a pretty good grip for your thumb and finger on them so they could scrape hides. There were lots of those pieces that we'd find. And he said a lot of it, he called them working tools. We got so we picked up every chip and then we'd spread them all out and try to identify what they might have been used for. We found squaw rock, or rock that the squaws used to smooth the leather when they were tanning it and preparing it for use. And they also were said to use those squaw rocks to finish off any wounded leftovers from their enemies that were in the area there. If the men had go out, the Indian men would go out to chase the others off, and the wives were left to kill off the leftover enemies. I thought that was a rather gruesome story, but we found the squaw rock, and Dr. Haynes and Mr. Seaman both identified it. Yes, they said that's what it is. It's just unbelievably smooth on the sides, but one of them's chipped a little bit that we found. We suppose that must have hit somebody real hard because a piece of the rock's chipped off.
Were all these working tools and things found, were they made of the same kind of rock?
Or no, there were various kinds. There were two or three different kinds, and they were different colors. Some of them would be brownish, some would be red, and some would be black, the obsidian, the volcanic glass. We also found three moccasin lasts, and they're a reddish rock. They're totally different from what the regular basalt color gray rock is, and we found them in three different sizes, that they could have made three different sizes of moccasins around those rocks. And they're very, very smooth because they've been used a great deal. And I suppose the leather left its effect on them, I don't know, but we're real pleased that we found those. The children, we had a sort of an unwritten rule that anything that we were absolutely sure was worth saving for the collection, and we capitalized that, we put in our cupboard. And then when the school was closed, we gave it to Pacific University, and I understand they still have it. But the children could keep anything that they individually found that they just felt they couldn't part with.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody came out pretty well. We had a collection of 72 artifacts, or 73 artifacts, and everybody had his own private collection. So, And the children were steeped in history. We had no trouble teaching Oregon history in that school. We had all 8 grades, and a wonderful, wonderful bunch of
There was never
students.
any stories at all of anyone finding any actual leather clothing or any
no.
baskets of anything.
No.
It was more or less a permanent rock.
It was only the rock and the working tools. I never heard of any baskets. I don't know. And I don't know why not, because I'll bet they made them out of the willow and things. But
well, they say that they were made, that they did have them,
mm-hmm.
My understanding. I've
I'm
never heard
curious.
Of anyone finding anything like
no.
that from the Tualatin Indians.
I'm curious. We made lots of baskets in the school, but that was our own. We were using native things. But we never found anything of that sort. We were real excited when we dug into the hill where the old medicine man was supposed to have been. And we found the charcoal fairly old down, maybe 10 inches or a foot deep, and we got real excited. We were just sure we'd found one of his campfires, and we found some bones close to it.
Oh, you did?
Oh, we got so excited. We thought we'd found something, and then somebody took them and analyzed them and insisted they were goat bones. I hope they were right, but it was terribly disappointing because we were so sure we'd found something important. But I guess our imagination, I'm sure, ran away with us, but we had a wonderful time doing it.
Well, I think what your class did was quite a valuable thing when it wasn't so popular to do such things as that.
That's right.
A concern for the Native Americans, or preserving some of the information while it's still fresh there. And it was almost like your own miniature, own foxfire project today.
Yes, it was. And there are so many things I've learned since then that I should have been doing, because when we found that campfire site, that should have been carefully investigated all around there, and we might really have unearthed some layers. But I didn't know anything about doing that then. I do now, and I certainly would have called somebody in, and we, before the dear folks built their house there, we would have done some intensive, because there could be several layers there of indication.
Could possibly still be there.
Could be. It very well could be. And as I say, the people there are very friendly, so.
Well, that's all the prepared questions I have. Maybe you would like to add a closing remark or anything that you think might be valuable to finish up with.
Well, I think the only thing should be a big thank you to the parents and the youngsters who were so patient with my interest in the things, and they always were contributing. I had one family that thought maybe some of their relatives had dug some of those holes up on the rocks, but they even went along with us and helped us with our excavations and things. And the parents never seemed to feel that we were invading their privacy. They were always very generous with their stories. And my school board members, of course, were right there in the middle of it, and they were so fine. And we had such a marvelous bunch of parents. Just had a wonderful time there. It's too bad to see the one-room schools leave, because they had a place in our early education, certainly. Mm-hmm. And this was one outgrowth of, I had all age levels, so I had all age interests. And they really grew up in the Indian history there when I had them for 14 years. All I can say is a big thank you, because it got me started on a lifelong interest.
Okay.